Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Erin Saltman on a report she co-authored with Melanie Smith about Western female immigrants to the Islamic State, titled Till Martyrdom Do Us Part, Gender and the ISIS Phenomenon.
We talked about a variety of issues related to female participation in jihadism, such as the push and pull factors leading women of different backgrounds to join ISIS and what the women are doing in the Islamic State territory once they arrive, among other things.
Erin is a senior researcher at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, where she oversees research and project development on women and extremism. She has expertise in both far-right and Islamist processes of radicalization, as well as counter-extremism and political socialization.
Thanks for coming on to the show today, Erin.
Thank you.
So for the listeners, we're going to be talking a little bit about a report that you and Melanie Smith came out with about a month or so ago called Till Martyrdom Do Us Part, Gender and the ISIS Phenomenon. Before we discuss the report, I was wondering, you know, why do you think Syria and Iraq are so unique? We really haven't seen this phenomenon previously in terms of many women emigrants going over to a conflict zone to join up with these groups. And do you think that this will become a new norm, or is it related more to the factors specific to Syria and Iraq?
Well, we've always seen women involved in some way, shape, or form in jihadist organizations. This is definitely not a completely new phenomena. People probably have heard somewhat about the Black Widow phenomena in Chechnya, and they were seen as this intensely media-frenzied group of women joining jihad and carrying out suicide attacks. However, the number, especially for Western women to be traveling so far abroad to join a jihadist organization, is definitely unprecedented. And I think that's probably distinctly because of two factors that make ISIS unique. And one of those is the caliphate, this declaration of this territory that's meant to be an embodiment of utopian society. So this space that can actually fulfill all these desires and hopes. And then the second thing is allowing for decentralized messengers. So allowing your supporters, your foreign fighters, your females to all tweet and post and basically upscale this message so that the image of a jihadist or a female jihadi bride all of a sudden is not secretive. You're actually in the household. You see what they're cooking for dinner. And that's really changed how comfortable people feel with the idea of it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, if you compare it to Al-Qaeda, I guess you could say that their media strategy is a lot more centralized, and they don't prefer that foot soldiers or activists really push out content. In the same way that the Islamic State sort of allows it, even though the Islamic State also has their own centralized, you know, bureaucratic media team, they're more willing to allow those that aren't a part of it to also send out their own messaging to supporters back at home, or whether to push for people to do attacks back at home and the like.
Exactly. And not only that, but because they're allowing so many supporters to take what might originally be a centralized media video and decentralize it out, is it also allows for the language to become fluent in a variety of different languages, using colloquialisms, using slang, using memes. So compared to 20 years ago, when something maybe sounded exactly like it was translated from Arabic to English, now it's completely fluent.
Yeah, exactly. They can really tailor to a particular audience. You know, we've seen a lot of media stories about women emigrating over to the Islamic State over the last year or so, and a lot of it seems a bit hyped up or sensationalistic. So what would you say are the biggest misconceptions about these female emigrants to the Islamic State?
I suppose the misconception that bothers me the most would be the gendered language around this phenomena. So if you look at media or public discourse around men that are going, you hear words like violent, angry, criminal young men. And when you hear the words used around women, you hear terms like naive, brainwashed, sexually groomed. And the problem with that is that equally, we could look at some of these men and say they're naive and groomed. But furthermore, we could look at some of these women and say they are angry, they are violent. If they could be holding the knife, they would gladly do it. And I think that's a big misperception.
Yeah, most definitely. And in a little bit, I'll be asking specifically about what these women are up to inside of the state. But before we get to that, turning to the actual report, I was wondering if you could lay out, you know, some of the push and pull factors that you guys talk about in the report. And do you think ahead of time, while these women are sort of going down this path to potentially leaving their home countries to go to Syria and Iraq, do you think these women truly know the reality of the life inside of the Islamic State ahead of time?
Well, so I guess that's two different sides. But first, about the push and pull factors, I mean, some of them are very similar to men. And the things that prime you to that extremist message, we definitely see that feeling of isolation or feeling culturally alienated, an identity crisis where you're not really sure where you belong. That's something probably every teenager faces, but especially if you're a second or third generation immigrant, that's a heightened sort of state of being. And then the feeling that there is this international Muslim community that as a whole is being violently persecuted. And that comes out very strongly when you look at how people have viewed the Assad government. And then that turns into a narrative about Israel and Palestine and continues to kind of involve more and more historical narratives until we get to the Ottoman Empire. And that can spiral really quickly, as well as just an anger and sadness or even frustration over this perceived lack of international action in response to this perceived persecution. So the fact that you didn't see Western governments stand up united against the Assad regime really affected quite a lot of people. But that's not, those things alone don't lead you to buy that ticket to Syria or sure. to Turkey or to France and then Turkey that gets to Syria. It's the pull factors are really, really based on positive things, actually probably things that we would want to see in any human rights campaigner. Things such as that idealistic goal of not only religious duty, but building a better world, building this utopian caliphate, as well as finding that belonging. For women, they talk about sisterhood and this group of women that don't backstab, that are true friends, that are with them till the end. And then there's really that romanticization of the whole experience, that adventure, that sense of going abroad for both men and women, but also for the women looking at these jihadi soldiers with the wind in their hair and the desert sky in the background. It's definitely, it's become a pop culture subculture. In essence. But whether or not they know the reality inside, it would be silly to think that they don't know how violent it is. Everyone knows about the beheading videos, especially at this point for people going out. We could say that the first wave of men going out before the declaration of the caliphate, we could say that they definitely were naive, that they would be co-opted into a terrorist group. But as far as this newer wave of people, we all know about the beheadings and the violence. Will they know exactly how it is on the ground? Definitely not. Women have a very different role to play than what they think they might in the beginning.
What do they think then the role that they will play?
Well, they're being told when we look at different forums, I mean, we're tracking what they're saying on Twitter, Facebook, Ask FM, Tumblr, WordPress, Instagram. And on the question forums, we've seen women asking specifically, can they fight? A lot of women would actually very much like to fight. And they are being told honestly that they won't, that they're meant to glorify their primary role as being a wife and a mother. That is their religious duty. And they're meant to glorify that quite heavily. But on top of that, they do have a strong role as safeguarding the ideology, spreading that, and recruiting and spreading more propaganda. But that the real reality of moving to a war zone, of joining a terrorist organization, everything from the lack of hot water, the lack of electricity, not knowing if your husband's going to come home, dealing with being a widow at the age of 17 after only being married 6 months and possibly being pregnant. These are really traumatic life experiences.
Yeah, no, definitely. Would you say that a large percent of these women have become disillusioned because of this, or is it harder to track this? Just because, you know, once you're on the ground inside of the Islamic State, they really try and sort of tighten that stuff for those that might be interested in trying to escape or leave.
Yeah, well, we see a couple different things take place with these women. We do see definitely this kind of second wave of radicalization. We see it in some of the men as well. Basically, you've arrived in this territory, it's a bit of a shock, and you almost need to further radicalize to justify to yourself why you're there. You've just left your family, you know it's almost impossible to go back. So sometimes we actually see women's voices getting more extreme and righteous and justified upon arrival. And we see that as an outcome propaganda tactic, but also almost for themselves to justify why they're there. We do have some cases of women that have left. As far as Western women goes, it's probably under 10, because it's 10 times harder for a woman to leave, not least because you have to have male permission to leave the household, and you have to have a male chaperone if you're outside of the household. So a stray woman walking towards the Turkish border puts herself immediately at risk. So whereas we have a couple hundred cases of men returning, we won't see that same phenomena with women. So they really have to justify to themselves why they've made this choice. But we're not going to get, because there's peer-to-peer judgment or censorship, it's not centrally censored for their Twitter accounts, but you couldn't wake up on Sunday and post, you know, hashtag gloomy Sunday in the caliphate. They're very much aware that what their role is online is to portray this idealistic utopian society. So in the cases that we do see perhaps a post or a tweet that is relaying some of the hardships, it's usually laced under what they're trying to swing as a positive or a recommendation, such as, hey, ladies, if you're coming out, bring an extra sweater because it gets cold. So, you know, they're freezing, there's no heater, there's no hot water. Or in some cases, just the realities of not speaking the native language. You are a stranger in a strange land. And we've seen some traumatic tales of, for example, a young female taking her friend to the hospital while she's miscarriaging and not being able to talk to the doctors and pretty much being ignored because they're not wanting to cater to the foreigners. I mean, these are some really traumatic events.
Yeah, so with that, how many women from the West do you think have gone since this phenomenon really started to pick up? And which countries are they specifically coming from in larger numbers?
The numbers, as you know from your extensive work, are always misleading and slightly unfulfilled.
Yeah, it's not a scientific sort of endeavor.
But I mean, we can give some rough estimates. The last numbers that we published with were really last calibrated in December. So we can say that this number is much higher. And in December, those numbers were estimated at around 550 Western women. However, Germany alone just recently published that they believe they have over 100 women that have gone. And that's in comparison to, you know, France and the UK would be considered to have more than that usually, since the trends previously showed that the UK and France had a higher number of women. So it's difficult to say, but we know that actually it seems like the female trend is on an increase. Some people have said that the male trend is on a slight waning or decrease. I don't know how that's being calibrated. However, we can say that we're seeing more and more trends of not only even younger women, but women with children, women with families. Although from the West, we do see that it's mostly late teens, early 20s. In our database alone, though, women are as young as 14, and our oldest female that's gone out is 46. So that's a huge range.
How do these women that are that young, especially those that are younger than 18, I don't know if, you know, what the laws are in you know, European countries, but I'm pretty sure in the United States that you need to travel with somebody who's over a certain age, if you're, you know, a certain younger age? Or is that not a factor? Like some 14-year-old kid could just go on a plane by themselves, or are there certain ways that they get around this?
Well, the interesting thing is that we'd love to keep thinking that these are naive young individuals, but most of the younger women that have gone have been shown to be highly intelligent, getting good grades in their classrooms. So some of these women, for example, in the case of the three Bethnal Green schoolgirls that went, one of the girls took her older sister's passport so that they would seem slightly older, or to have one person in the group that was slightly older. In other cases, similar things had happened, or there is believed that maybe forgery of a parent letter to get through certain bits had taken place. Definitely security and monitoring systems were flagged and kind of judged heavily on the fact that these younger women were allowed to go. But there's also the problem that, especially in Europe, when it's really easy to maybe take a small flight or train, which is less regulated, just to a neighboring country and then make the bigger flight from that country, it means that Europol doesn't usually detect it. And we see this happening on the Ask.fm forums when they're giving advice to the younger women that are now trying to come over, saying, well, don't fly directly. Just make one stop in a neighboring country first and then make your flight to Turkey from there. Because basically each nation is only dealing with their own nationals.
Yeah. Do you see a difference between those that are coming from Europe versus those who are maybe coming from North America and the US and Canada or even Australia? I imagine that that might be a bit more difficult to travel than if you're that young, or has it not been as much of a barrier either?
Well, the numbers from Europe are obviously going to be higher. It's going to be easier for a person coming from Europe, not least because it's just closer to the territory.
Yeah, exactly.
There are better and easier flight paths. So when we saw, for example, the Sharouf family come from Australia, that's a very expensive flight. It's not actually that easy to book for an entire family. Although there was a very big offline network assisting with that family as well. So that was within the community. And we do think if you're coming from farther away, there's probably networks that are helping you. Sometimes it's thought possibly financially, but also just logistically. And that's happening both online and offline.
So, yeah. And are most of these women based in Syria, I would imagine? Or have you seen cases where these women are in Iraq as well?
Most are based in Syria. We try to geolocate. I mean, we try to take in as many data points as possible, age, whether or not they're pregnant or with child or husband, marital status, background, education, everything we can, we try to log. But as far as location, a lot of them are going to be based in the bigger strongholds like Raqqa. Mm-hmm. However, some of them are straying out further, and it's thought that definitely some people take their wives to the front line more so if they're trying to stake out a city and it's somewhat been cleared, and then they try to just divide and conquer, basically, just like you would have in the Roman Empire. You bring some of the locals, even if they might be foreign fighters or wives of foreign fighters, you bring some of the locals to that spot to almost stake claim on it. So we do know that women are not just in Raqqa. They are spread out. In the case of the Helaini twins, they were separated for quite a while, where one sister was in Raqqa and the other one was sort of traveling outwards. But that's kind of a movable feast. Things are changing on the ground all the time.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that many of these women, when their interest was being piqued by potentially going over, that they wanted to fight. And of course, as we know, they don't really do that inside of the Islamic State. So I was just wondering if you could detail a little bit for those listening, you know, the different variety of actions or activities or things that these women and girls are doing once they're in Islamic State territory.
They're, as I said, kind of their first and primary role will be to be a wife and help produce the next generation of jihadists. And that really is glorified heavily. And women are told that they should be honoring that role and taking that on in full. But outside of that, they are being allowed to take on online profiles if they want. As I said, we're tracking over 111 different women online through their profiles, and that's not all of them. Those are just the ones we've been trying to track and grow that network. But other than that, there is some space for women to take on some smaller roles in teaching. We profiled one woman who happens to have a medical background, and she was allowed to open her own clinic. So she was able to be a female practitioner. However, that's going to be very limited. There are some women that we have seen that are undergoing light military training, and that is a more recent development. So when we get these images in the media of groups of women holding guns and having training, this is very much casted over every single article that comes out about women now. However, they're not being used as combatants. We have not, from our end, we've not seen women at the front line. And from what we know of the rule of law there, it's being said that really women should not be used in military capacity as long as there are enough male forces. And it's almost a bragging point that there are plenty of male forces, more coming every day, so they don't need to use women. So actually, if we saw women, if we did see them starting to actually carry out combat, this would be a sign that male ISIS forces were actually highly depleted. But seeing them in this role also definitely increases asymmetrical threat perception. As soon as we see those images, we have to start questioning females more within how we're viewing ISIS. And also, it just allows for these women to have an outlet. Many of these women would like to be participating in violence, and having the outlet to have some light military training actually alleviates that.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, in some of the things I've looked at and read that, you know, obviously you mentioned the woman who is, you know, starting her own clinic. But I've also seen cases where women have been teachers and nurses and also involved in sort of the Hizbah activities of the Islamic State, especially, you know, at checkpoints where women would be checking the women because the men couldn't do that, or, you know, making sure that, you know, women were keeping up with all the different morality type of rulings that the Islamic State inputted. Maybe that's only Arab women that are doing this, whether they're Syrian or Iraqis, or whether they're women from other Arab countries. Have you seen any Westerners involved in these types of activities or not?
Yeah, so there have been some reports about the Al-Hanza Brigade, which is a female morality policing brigade. And actually, it was the Al-Hanza Brigade which produced this manifesto for women about looking at what the rules and regulations were for women. And so it is thought that there are these policing units of women, these smaller units that will go and carry out checks as well as light punishments for other women. For example, if your veil was too transparent or if your dress was slightly too short. So they would go around and monitor this. From what we know, this is mostly local, more Arabic, Middle Eastern women, some Turkish women. We don't really have a grip that there are Western women within this. There were some reports that wanted to say that they thought Aksa Mahmood, this Glaswegian woman, was part of that. But we don't actually see that taking place on the ground to our knowledge.
Yeah. And in the report, you discussed a little bit about how these women and girls, there's no one specific profile. So I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit of the different backgrounds, because I know that you had some case studies of some of the different women that have gone.
Yeah, we would love as practitioners and researchers to think that we can narrow down a profile, because it would really make countering extremism and counterterrorism a lot easier. But with women especially, as I said, the ages range. Just in our database, they range from age 14 to 46. The different countries, we have women from that are Dutch, French, Swiss, Australian, from Finland, from Bosnia, everywhere. There is no one profile. In some cases, they had family members that left before them. So in the case of the Helaney twins, they had an older brother that already made the journey. Or in the case of the Bethnal Green girls, they had a friend that went before them. So we see this offline connection. But in other cases, like Aksa Mahmood or many of the other women, we don't see that family played a role or that they had an open friend group that played a role. So it's very difficult. And the problem is also the fact that although the internet is not the spark of radicalization, it's not what introduces you to it. You don't go shopping for shoes online and accidentally become a jihadist. But once you are introduced to the networks online, it definitely serves as a catalyst and a facilitator for that process. And so we know that previously you would assume that radicalization done intensely could take maybe 3 to 6 months. But now there are some cases where really they're looking at profiles that seem to be radicalizing within a matter of weeks. And that makes it really difficult for monitoring and surveillance to pick up on this at all.
So would you say then that many of these women that have gone are pretty new to this whole milieu and that most of them were not actively involved in some of the more homegrown type of activities that are happening in Western Europe, like stuff with Al-Muhajirun and all their different branches in other, European countries?
For the men, we can definitely see that those networks played a strong role, especially in the first waves that we're going over. But for the women, there are some examples where their fathers had been connected or brothers had been connected to groups like the Anjem Chowdhury, Al-Muhajirun networks, or with Sharia for Belgium or some others. But most of the females that we're seeing, we don't see the fact that they're part of these homegrown semi-legal extremist networks. We see that they're really coming at this as a new subculture, something that is almost trendy to be a part of.
So where do you think this is all going to go now? How long do you foresee people going over there? Or this just becoming a new norm? And what effect do you think this will have on sort of the homegrown scene for those women who might want to go but cannot go and are prevented but are not necessarily, imprisoned? Will this affect what's going on in the different communities inside of Europe now potentially?
This is definitely going to have a much more long-term effect. As far as this movement goes, this sort of trending of joining Islamic State, a lot of that is going to be dependent on the continuation of the statehood. In fact, you could argue that because this declared terrorist state has existed now for a year, that really does give it legitimacy. Some people that might have been questioning in the beginning whether or not to go are really seeing this now and thinking, this is really stable. God has willed this state to continue. It is winning from what a lot of people can see, which is shocking.
So we might actually then see a bigger or another wave of people starting to go now.
It's possible that you see another wave. I think that some trends are saying that it's slowing. So there's always limitations to perhaps a pop culture if it's not as trendy. If it's not as trendy to go, or if people have moved on to another topic, then there will be a ceiling. I don't think that we're going to see 1 in 10 people go to try to join Islamic State. But the effects of the ideology, that process of radicalization, there's a lot of different stages you could be at, and starting to question the idea of martyrdom and starting to agree that maybe this isn't the right caliphate state, but we should be working towards something like that. Those are very dangerous ideologies for European and Western nation states to have pockets of individuals that are really thinking that democracy is not the right way to go, that human rights are overrated, that we have this self and other identity, this good and evil fight that's being solidified. It's not going to go away very quickly.
So do you think then, just thinking out loud and off the top of my head, based off the conversation we've had and how you mentioned that some of these women actually want to fight. And now that there's more and more information about what's happening to the women while they're in the territory, do you think it's possible for women to then think that instead of going to the Islamic State's territory because they actually want to conduct some type of violence, that we could actually potentially see inspired lone wolf type of women attacks in the future because they might prefer that instead of, you know, being more submissive if they go over to Syria?
I think that women are just as likely to be allured by the lone wolf phenomena as some men are. In fact, more recently, in the last month or two, there was a case of two Spanish women that were arrested on charges of planning a terrorist attack. And as it turns out, their husbands were completely shocked by this. But these two women had been meeting in private and had been acquiring the materials needed to carry out an attack. So we already see that there is some seeding of that sort of idea for women. And we also know that even though women are not allowed to carry out violence within Islamic State at the moment, that Islamic State is supporting women that are trying to carry it out abroad. The Jordanian hostage situation was the perfect example where ISIS could have asked for many different people in exchange for the release of for the Jordanian pilot. And they specifically asked for a failed suicide bomber attack done by a female. And that sent a very strong message that ISIS supports and tries to rescue its females. So we do see that that's taking place.
Yeah, and with past cases like Malika El Arood, who is very proficient in everything that she was doing last decade. And then, of course, more recently, we saw the case, not in the West, but in the Emirates, where that woman stabbed the American teacher there. I don't know, it was a few months ago, maybe now. So it's not unforeseen.
No, it's not unforeseen. And we see some precedents for that. And, you know, we still have that entire wave of women that were openly being called for by Akawi and ideologues that really supported this idea. So there's definitely space for women in the lone sector abroad, but also potentially eventually within Islamic State territory. We haven't seen that yet, but just like in Chechnya, there's space for that to develop in the future.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens going forward. So are you and Melanie continuing this research? Are you guys looking at different angles related to this topic now, or are you focusing on something else? What are you guys working on now?
Well, we're continuing the database, definitely. We're tracking when the sites get taken down, when they reappear, trying to reconfirm identities. That's definitely something that we don't want to just give up because we happen to publish one report on it. That's information that will develop over time. For example, we already, since the publication of the report, see a much larger trend of people making their profiles private or secret. So now it's not open access material. So that's as a cause of a lot of takedowns and backlashes online that women have been receiving. So that's already a changing playing field just in a matter of 1 or 2 months. But as far as what we're looking at next, we're really looking at the countering space. So we recently, through ISD, launched a Women in Extremism Network core team of 25 women from around the world, from the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Europe, and North America. And they're made up of activists, practitioners, and researchers. And we're trying to start bring together more on the ground knowledge and expertise, trying to map out some of the trends.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess we'll have to stay tuned to see what you guys come up with. Thanks for coming onto the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now it's time for our hashtag social media segment, where we'll be covering social media posts between June 30th and July 10th.
Between June 30th and July 10th, 11 foreign fighters died in Syria with the Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra, while 16 died in Iraq with the Islamic State.
During that same time, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula claimed 28 military operations.
On July 1st, Furat Media, the semi-official Caucasus jihadis in the Islamic State media outlet, created DVDs with translations of ISIS releases to hand out to brothers in the caliphate in Russian.
July 4th, Islamic State announces it will soon be broadcasting its radio station, Idiat al-Bayan, in Wilayat al-Fallujah. It's already in Wilayat Nineveh, al-Raqqa, and Khair, a.k.a. Deir ez-Zor.
On July 6th, the Islamic State started building new shops in Wilayat al-Fallujah, whereas in the past they had previously only been building outside markets. Now they're attempting to build actual brick-and-mortar structures.
July 9th, Islamic State gets Baya from the Jabir clan in Wilayat Dijla.
On the same day, Jaish al-Muhajirun wal-Ansar of the umbrella group Jabhat Ansar al-Din in Syria distributed a number of Ramadan baskets to the needy in Aleppo.
On July 9th, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula announces the death of two Saudi foreign fighters in Yemen.
Similarly, on July 9th, the Islamic State in Darna announces the death of a Sudanese foreign fighter that attacked the so-called Sahawat, most likely referring to the Abu Salim Martyrs Brigade.
And also on July 9th, the Islamic State in Sinai has its first Dawah event.
The next day, on July 10th, the Islamic State in its Wilayat Dijla opens a free public phone point for ordinary citizens.
Also on the 10th, the Islamic State builds a new media point in Al-Zab district of Wilayat Dijla.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thank you to Erin for coming onto the show and sharing her expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.